With Election Day just 2 weeks out and early voting underway now, congressional candidate and Republican Glo Smith is in studio and taking your calls about her race for Congress. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross, and we are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And just ahead, the issues at stake this November as we speak with candidate Glo Smith. Get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, how faith leaders and mental health advocates on the First Coast are coming together. Plus, we'll hear from an NPR favorite, the Squirrel Nut Zippers, as they play Jacksonville tonight. All of that and more ahead this hour. But first this morning, with an agenda of job creation, tax reform, and support for veterans, local business owner Glo Smith is the Republican candidate for Congress here in North Florida's District 5. She and Democrat Al Lawson of Tallahassee are vying to take the seat in Congress that will be vacated in January by Corrine Brown. She's lost her seat in the wake of redistricting and an ethics scandal. Glo Smith joins us now in studio with more about her campaign as she takes your calls. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being with us. And we're talking about the presidential election, but more importantly, the race for Congress in this area as Glo Smith seeks the seat being vacated by longtime Representative Corrine Brown. What are your questions for her? Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show or weigh in on Facebook. And so, Glo Smith, this is the second time you've run for this seat. You're facing Al Lawson, Democrat of Tallahassee, in the general election. And you're running on a market of job creation and tax reform. Tell us a little bit about your campaign.
Well, sure. I've had the pleasure, like you said, of running in 2014, felt a calling again to run in 2016 for many reasons. Even with the redrawn district, we still have too many people that are unemployed in our state and definitely in our district. So my desire is to help create jobs here in Northeast Florida. Lower taxes is another thing that's very important for us. We realize that more and more people are taking home less but paying more in taxes in a variety of ways. And those are just two of the basic foundations of our campaign. I want to run to have an opportunity to serve the people, to be their voice in Washington, and to have an opportunity to make a difference in our district.
And how would you go about that? Corrine Brown, of course, is leaving under a cloud of ethics charges and also the redrawn district, which is slightly less Democratic than it was before. You're running as a Republican in a district that still is tilted in favor of the Democrat. If you win, if you beat Al Lawson, how would you go about creating jobs in this district?
Well, we'll definitely work with our local and state organizations and business people, but more importantly, work across the aisle in Washington. We all understand that people need to work regardless of what their political ideology and affiliations are. And the fact that Corrine Brown is leaving opens up an opportunity for me to go and represent the people and to let them understand that I have the experience as an entrepreneurship. I know what it's like to help small businesses start and to continue on to grow strong. I understand the value of small businesses to our country. So I want to definitely have an opportunity to go to Washington, work across the aisle, to do whatever we can to bring jobs to Florida.
And how in your view, could Congress be doing a better job of that?
Well,
Congress isn't exactly popular these days.
They are not, but I think first and foremost is looking at the regulations that have been imposed on small businesses that are truly stifling not only new entrepreneurship, but just innovation in and of itself. I think that whenever we have too many regulation, it stunts the growth of small businesses. And we all know that that's the backbone of our society. So I think that's one of the biggest problems. And then two, having funds come to the state to support not only local business owners, but the state business owners, and to make sure that people have an opportunity to own their business, that we are in a position to create and to be innovative again and to reward the risk that people are willing to take in order to grow jobs in our economy.
It's 549-2937 to connect with congressional candidate Glo Smith. What would be an example of that? A regulation you think is hurting business, and what would be an example of a way to reward a business?
Well, I think there are a lot of regulations. When you look at just trying to get a business up and started, the taxes and the fees that small business owners who usually don't have a whole lot of startup cash have to pay just to become licensed in this state. weight is all, you know, is an issue for a lot of business owners that I talk to. So I know personally, you know, I'm talking to people in this district that are just simple people. For instance, it may not sound important, but I met a couple of people who just braid hair, and they were just telling me that they now have to go through this entire process. They're not working with chemicals or anything else. They're doing something that has been in their family and in their race of people forever, and now having to deal with the government at that level has been stifling to them to even get started and to continue what they've been doing for years and years and years. But it goes beyond that. I mean, it's all kinds of businesses that are coming into contact with all of these regulations, you know, that says we have to be able to pay tax. I mean, not only taxes, but you have to file for these particular licenses. And it's just a lot of money. And so I think that affects people who want to be innovative. Right now, people are not taking risks like they used to. And that's a problem when we see that we have an opportunity to create businesses, whether it's through technology or other forms. And whenever we discourage that, then I think we hurt our country overall.
At a recent forum between you and your opponent, Al Lawson, at the Southside Businessmen's Club, you talked about a number of other issues, everything from the Trans-Pacific Partnership to the $20 trillion debt this country is struggling with, whether to deepen Jaxport, a host of issues. And I'm quoting from this piece in Florida Politics. Both candidates revealed serious policy deficiencies, which augur poorly for either of them going to Washington and hitting the ground running. What would you say to those who, while they deplored Corrine Brown's ethical issues, at least liked the fact that she swung a heavy bat on Capitol Hill? They don't think either you or Lawson can bring home to the district what she did.
Right. Well, I totally disagree with that. You have to take into consideration that the Congresswoman was there for almost 24 years. Yes, you have two new candidates vying to go to Washington for the first time, but we bring our experience. For me personally, I bring my experience with helping to start business. I've been a public servant for over 30 years. I understand what it's like to work across the aisle. I had the opportunity to do that.
And when you say a public servant for over 30 years, how so?
I've worked in for public agencies. I've worked for the Department of Children and Families. I've worked in law enforcement. I've worked with community profits and nonprofit organizations. I helped start a resource center in Green Cove Springs. So I think bringing 30 years of hands-on experience, I provided constituent services when I worked for Lieutenant Governor Carroll and Governor Scott. So those things qualify me to go to Washington. Yes, I have a lot to learn, but what I do know that it is time for a change and that I am the best candidate to serve the people in the 5th District. So when reporters say that Glo Smith is not qualified, you have to look at the context. If you look at someone who's been in Congress for 20 years or longer, of course they have experiences, but I'm willing to go there to fight for our veterans, to fight for the people in this district, and to put my experience at work where people can see that I am the best candidate for this position.
Let me ask you one more question about this race, and then we'll go to lots of calls for Glo Smith. You're a woman, you're a Republican, and you're African American. On the campaign trail, other candidates running for Congress right now in Florida are running away as fast as they can from Donald Trump, particularly in more competitive districts. David Jolly in Tampa comes to mind. He's actually threatening legal action against a television ad put on by the Democrats that links him to Donald Trump. What is your position when you talk to voters in your district who want to know where you stand on Donald Trump's controversies, particularly his comments about women?
Well, I think that people who talk to me understand that I'm in the 5th District running for Congress. I stay away from whatever decision people want to make between Clinton and Trump. They both have their issues. I wish personally we had two better candidates, but we don't. It is what it is. I stay focused on the 5th District. I'm not running for Trump, nor am I running for Clinton. I'm running for Congress in Florida's 5th District. I think people have to be able to vet the information for themselves and see which candidate will provide this country a better opportunity to move forward. And whatever decision they make is between them and their candidate and hopefully God.
All right, lots of calls for Republican Glo Smith. She's running against Democrat Al Lawson in the redrawn District 5. That's the district held for more than two decades by Corrine Brown, who is leaving Congress in January. The district used to run north-south from Jacksonville down to Orlando. Now it runs east-west from Jacksonville over to Tallahassee. Lots of calls. Let's go to your comments right now as we talk politics at 549-2937. Tina is in Palatka. Hi, Tina. Good morning.
Yes, I'm still here.
Hey, good morning.
Flo.
You're on the air.
Good morning,
yes.
Tina.
Hi. Good morning, Flo. I was moved by your passion. I'm an entrepreneur, too, retired now, but There's so much corruption, Flo, everywhere.
Glow, it's glow. Yeah.
Flow,
yeah.
I'm sorry.
That's all right.
Well, Flow is a glow, I'm telling you.
It's okay.
And you're talking about what's up against small business. We know and we've always heard small business is the backbone of America. When the dollar transaction fee was implemented, I believe small businesses under a certain level of income should have been exempt. That had put so many out of business, and that's just my comment to you, and good luck. I'm going to vote for you.
Well, thank you so much.
And goodbye to Ms. Congresswoman Brown, and good luck to her.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. Dave in Nassau County. Hey, Dave, good morning.
Good morning. My question's simple. Do you accept climate science? Because we are, after all, in the state that is going to be most affected by global warming and sea level rise. And we have, in our state, the scientists that have no doubt about the man-made influence on global warming. Do you accept climate science, or are you backing what the Republican attitude is that says essentially that they deny the science?
Well, I think that general statement in and of itself is stereotyping. You cannot put one group of people or a political affiliation totally into one category. I think that there is evidence on both sides of the aisle. More importantly, that there are scientists who agree to disagree. So I think that it's important that when you generalize and you say Republicans only, or you think that, then that automatically puts a flaw into what you believe. Yes, the science is out there, but I also know that there is two sides to every story, and I look at all of it. So that's kind of my stand.
Okay, let me follow up on Dave's question. The overwhelming majority of scientific consensus is that climate change is real and that sea level rise is happening. NOAA, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers here in Florida, is already planning mitigation against sea level rise. That's a federal agency. Miami-Dade County is already experiencing sea level rise and planning to mitigate against it. We are not seeing the effects in North Florida as much yet as they are in South Florida. But to say that there are two sides to the story really presents a false equivalency over what the worldwide overwhelming scientific consensus sees as settled science. So if you're elected as Congresswoman to this district, how will you address the issue of sea level rise in our coastal areas?
Again, I would look at both sides of the story. I think there are credible scientists on both sides of the issue. I'm not saying that it's not legitimate and it's not occurring, but I also say that there are scientists who understand that there is some climate change, but not to the degree that we have talked about it. I would continue to do what I'm doing, and it is to research and to learn more. I am not in a position today to say this is what I will absolutely do on one side or the other.
But if we are dealing with the real-world impact of sea level rise on our coastal shores here in Duval County, Nassau County, it would be incumbent upon you to know the research, to provide the funding, and to support the federal agencies that are trying to mitigate this problem.
Right, and that's why I said to you, Melissa, that I would have to learn more about it. It's not one of the top priorities that I've been focusing on. And I think, in all fairness, that I cannot say that I would do this or that because I just don't know a lot. Thank you.
Okay, let's go to a few more of your calls. Let's go to Dwayne in Jacksonville. Dwayne, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
How are you guys doing this morning?
Doing well, thank you.
Yes, my question for Glow was what made you choose the Republican Party over the Democrat Party as running as a Republican? Is it that you believe in smaller government? I just want to hear some of your views on why you chose the Republic to run as a Republican.
I have always been a Republican from the very first day I registered to vote. I came from a home where my mother was married at a very young age, at 13, to my father. By the time she was 20, She had me, and I was her fifth child. My father was in the military. And when she turned 21, she had my sixth brother. Shortly after that, my mother and father, my biological father, divorced. We're living in the Blodgett homes in Jacksonville, Florida. Even though my mother was on welfare, she always worked. She actually was an elevator operator for a major bank downtown. When she turned 23, two cousins came to live with us. And when she turned 25, my grandmother passed. Like my grandmother was a young married woman having children. Literally, they were having babies at the same time. At 25, when my grandmother passed, it was horrible, but at the same time, it turned out to be a blessing because we were able to move out of the projects into a thriving black neighborhood where I did not only see helplessness and hopelessness and everyone around me being poor, but now for the first time, I got to see black people that owned their own homes, that were business people, that were educated, they were doctors, and they were lawyers and teachers and community leaders. And so I knew at that early age that there was something different and there was more than what I ever thought could be possible. Well, during that time, my mother met my stepfather, but because of all of the things that she had gone through, she really did not have time for another man. When we moved, they lost contact for several years. One day, he runs into her with me and my little brother. Now, here my stepfather is from Trinidad and Tobago, an educated black engineer, the first black engineer and supervisor at the Jacksonville shipyard. He came to this country because he knew two things, that the Constitution of our country was great and that anyone could come here and make it. He loved the Constitution and he loved the Word of God. You see, not only was he educated, he was a businessman. He owned stores in our community. He owned a trucking line. He owned property. My father said that you had an opportunity to give back, but more importantly, you had an opportunity to make it and to be what you can. So I grew up with very conservative values. Even though my family are majority Democrat, we've always been taught to vote our values and to vote for the best candidate, regardless of their political party. Now, when my dad talked to us about being conservative, it was because of smaller government, less taxes, the opportunities that the Republican Party support, the sanctity of human life, just all of those things. So it was just naturally for me to fall into that category. But again, we were taught to vote for the best candidate. I get pushback on both sides of the aisle. This country is so divided right now, David. We have got to bring people together. There are flaws in both parties. To be honest with you, when I look at both parties, especially as an African-American and in the district that I'm running in, neither one have done really well by us. So I think for me to tell you why, you know, yes, I believe in smaller taxes. Yes, I believe that, you know, in those conservative values that Republicans stand for. But I also am a social conservative. I'm very concerned because I know what it's like to depend on government commodities, you know, to depend on the government to provide your shelter and your food and your transportation and your housing. I understand that. But I also know what it's like to excel beyond that and to have the opportunity to be everything that you can be in this country through a trade and or education. So I get it because of where I came from. It makes me even more qualified because when you look at the old district that I ran in 2014, when you look compared us to all 27 districts, we were at the bottom for everything. These entitlement programs, yes, we need them, but they have to be redesigned. And one of the things that I want to do when I go to Congress is to provide people an opportunity to get off of these programs. For us in the African American community, in every community, it's generational and it's a big problem.
And how would you go about that? How would you reform? And when we talk about entitlements, I mean, the bulk of that is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. How would you reform those programs?
Yeah, I think Social Security, we have to start seriously looking at maybe privatization. We've got people paying into the system right now when we know that the money will not be available in the next decade or two.
You would privatize Social Security?
That would be on the table, definitely, because right now we know that we're running out of money. But we have to make sure
they dispute that, by the way, the Social Security. Security Administration.
Okay.
They do not believe that.
The Congressional Budget Office does not dispute that.
When you interview the Social Security Administration, they will allow, and I'm just repeating what they're saying,
right,
they will allow for the fact that the system needs, that perhaps the retirement age could be raised, but they dispute the notion that it's going broke.
Right. And I think you have to face reality. The fact that less people are working, I'm not talking about the U3 unemployment rate, but when you look at the true unemployment rate of people who are not even looking for a job, you don't have people paying into a system. So that disputes their fight. The government budget office says something totally different. And plus, you can do research. But right when I'm talking about entitlement programs, I'm not only talking about Social Security and Medicaid, but more importantly, the other programs that make up the entitlement programs. You know, I was taught that you had to work for a living and that if you are in a position to give back, then you do that. So but here's what's so sad. that is right now in the 5th District and throughout this country, we know that more people are receiving government assistance, whether it's food stamp, cash assistance, Section 8 housing. It goes on and on and on. What we don't have right now in our country is a plan to gradually stout people down over 5 to 10 years. You see, right now, those programs were never designed to help you grow wealth or to strengthen the family. So we need to create a system, especially when it's been a generational issue and problem, ongoing problem, to help people gradually step down. So if you are lucky enough or blessed enough to get a job and you make minimum wage or even $15 an hour, you don't take every entitlement away from someone right away. You give them an opportunity to step down and help reform. But we also know that there's a problem with entitlement programs when 70% of our budget in this country goes to two major entitlement programs, and the rest is left for all the other programs that are out there. So there's a lot that needs to be done in that area.
Lots of calls, meanwhile, for candidate Glo Smith. Paul in St. John's County, go ahead, Paul. You've been holding a while. If you're still there, go ahead.
Oh, that's fine. My question was, and you kind of asked it, Melissa, but you asked about who, if she, my question was, is if she endorsed the head of her ticket, which she kind of worked around that answer. My question really is, will be more direct. Are you going to vote for Donald Trump?
And I would tell you, like I said before, I think that's a personal decision that I get to make. I do support my nominee, like you probably support yours, but I am running for Congress in Florida's 5th District, and that's where my concentration is.
Thanks for the call, Paul. And we've got calls and questions about all manner of issues. It pretty much runs the gamut this morning. Let's go down to Orange Park. Sarah in Orange Park. Go ahead, Sarah.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question, Glo, because you spoke about business regulation and how you're really focusing on that. I wonder how you're focusing on regulation for the people, particularly in regards to medical marijuana as it creates jobs and decriminalizes a healthy chunk of the population.
Okay. Amendment 2, that will be on the ballot again, whether to legalize medical marijuana in Florida. That's not really the purview of a Congress represent, you know, a congressman, but that'll be decided by amendment. But where are you on that?
Well, for municipal purposes, I think I could go along with it. But for overall, I would not support Amendment 2.
Well, it would legalize it for medical use. So yes. Would you be in favor of that?
At the state level, yes.
Okay. Carrie in San Marco. Hi, Carrie. Good morning. You're on the air.
Yes. I just wanted to make a finer tune on what she's talking about with regard to people out of work and people that don't choose to work. I just would like her, if she were to discern between how many people at home that are not working that have some form of addiction, whether it be gambling, prescription drugs, or any other type of drug, alcohol. And if she were to look at the data and see how many of those people are really just addicts, rather than decide that people aren't worthy of help, especially young moms. And that's all I want to say. And if she would comment, please. Thank you.
Yeah, most definitely. I never said that people are not worthy of help. What I did say is that when we look at the unemployment numbers, we know that there are a large people that are no longer in the workforce for a variety of reasons. But not only that, you bring up an interesting point. There is data out there that suggests that mental illnesses has also increased due to lack of people employment. For instance, a particular article I was reading out of a New York paper talked about the connection between the average person, and it was very specifically talking about men in the workforce or out of the workforce, how on average now that they are staying home and watching 5.5 hours of television a day, and they've been able to do research that linked that to mental illnesses, to all kinds of depression and anxiety, and we see those numbers going up and up and up. So I would never tell you that I'm not going to help anyone. I've spent my life in social services. I've worked in the child welfare system. I've worked for the Department of Children and Families in other areas. So I think we do help people, and I think we give them a helping hand up. And
but isn't that what those programs are? You're saying they create a long-term dependency. So how would we spend money, I guess, in a different way, as you said, to transition people out?
To create jobs and give them opportunities to work. Right now, you know, I talked to someone the other day who's a small business owner, and he said to me, Glo, I'm at that number where I have over 50 employees. I went from paying, and insurance premium, which he covers for all of his employees, from just under $200,000 2 years ago to almost $500,000. That's a huge problem for a lot of small business owners that I'm talking to. But also for people that are on entitlement programs, like I said, even though even back when my mother was on those programs, she always worked. And I'm not saying everyone can work because situations are different. But you have to be able to provide people an opportunity to enhance their lives. And prosperity looks different for all of us. And I'm not talking about monetarily. It could be spiritually or physically or whatever you decide that is for you, is one of the things that I think people reach for. And it looks different for all of us in our families. I think when people cannot work and give back, when men and women cannot take care of their families, it just brings them down even more. And we see issues in the mental health areas out of that. And sometimes it does lead to addiction.
And both you and your opponent, Al Lawson, are facing the task right now of introducing yourself really to the district, this newly redrawn District 5, and getting your message out. What are your closing arguments, I guess, to voters in the district that are just getting to understand this race and these candidates,
right,
you and your opponent?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I want people to know is to get to know me and to know my history and to understand that I've been a public servant for over 30 years. I bring not only entrepreneurship experience, but I bring the experience of having a proven record. Whether you look at the Green Coast Springs Resource and Referral Center that I helped get started with my agency in Clay County, that have served over 5,000 children, over 2,000 families. People can go there. It's a safe haven for people to be able to go and look for a job, to get counseling for mental health, just a variety of things. But more importantly, I want people to know that I want to represent the people. We've got to get away from Republican and Democrat. Let's put people first, because I can't tell you, Melissa, the difference at the end of the day between a homeless and a jobless Republican, independent, or Democrat. I'm just a public servant who wants to serve. I want to learn as much as I can, and I want to go to Washington to make a difference.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much to the callers.
Glo Smith is the Republican running in the race to replace outgoing Congresswoman Corrine Brown in Congressional District 5. We've extended an invitation to her opponent in this race, Democrat Al Lawson. Early voting is underway right now. And much more still ahead. We'll be right back.
Legal and political segments on First Coast Connect, brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Beyond the stump speeches.
Everything she touches has turned bad.
Issues, not insults.
Build the wall.
Equal pay for women's work.
And the latest headlines.
The new week is bringing new revelations in the race for president.
NPR brings you.
The American people don't feel certain.
It is quite a struggle across the board.
I just don't think it's as easy to get by in the world today.
The voices behind the votes. Listen every day.
Morning Edition and All Things Considered. Every day on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday through Saturday nights on 89.9 when we bring you music from around the world. All styles played, all songs considered. Join me for the Electro Lounge, Tuesday through Saturday nights.
Welcome back. At the intersection of faith and mental health is a place where advocates are coming together this week on the First Coast to tackle the deep-seated mental health problems in this community. as Baptist Health hosts its third annual Faith and Mental Health Conference. Actually, it's next Friday at the Schultz Center in Jacksonville. We've got a preview right now as we welcome Dr. Ellen Williams, PhD, Administrator for Baptist Behavioral Health. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, the Reverend Kyle Reese, pastor at Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And this is a free conference open to the public, Dr. Williams.
Yes, it is.
Looking at how faith and mental health professionals can work together, that's a pretty powerful concept, it sounds like.
Yes, well, there's a big intersection between faith communities and mental health treatment. One of the major,
that's okay.
One of the major issues is that stigma around mental health can be cut people off from their communities and even their families, and the faith community can help to provide a support around people with mental illness and also help their families cope with people with mental illnesses.
Now, there will be a lot of speakers at this, including Sheriff Mike Williams and others. Kyle Reese, when you talk about how faith leaders can be part of this solution, how do you see your role?
Well, I think one of the things that oftentimes happens is that faith leaders are the first line of folks who are in distress and who are trying to put the pieces of their life together. So faith leaders need to be in conversation with those in behavioral health. Faith leaders need to know their limits and when to refer. And then I think behavioral health leaders need to continue to know that faith can play a part in the healing process. And so this collaboration and this conversation is needed on both sides.
What are some specific policy areas or solutions that you're looking at Baptist Behavioral Health, Dr. Williams? Because Baptist has really made a heavy play for addressing this issue in this community. And it's a big issue, not only in our community, but statewide when you look at funding, awareness, stigma, the whole range of problems.
Yes, and there really are two major ways in the last couple of years that we've expanded the reach of behavioral health in Jacksonville. One is integrating into primary care offices at Baptist, and that creates a less stigmatizing way for people to access a mental health care professional. If they're in their primary care provider's clinic, then they can just kind of connect through their doctor to a mental health professional. And another way, just tomorrow, we're opening, have a grand opening for the new Children's Center, the Wolfson Children's Center for Behavioral Health, down in the San Marco area. And we're really focusing on mental health care for children in the community. And that's because mental illness really often starts in childhood. It's a childhood disease process. So by looking at tackling early identification and early treatment, we can help to mitigate long-term consequences of not treating mental illness.
And it does start in childhood. Kyle Reese, one of the topics that the faith community is looking at is youth suicide, which is at epidemic levels, correct?
It is. And I know faith communities across the community are invested in the lives of students. And again, the resources out there and the faith community, I think, can provide for students a safe space to articulate their struggles, and as faith leaders then to know the resources that Baptist and other providers have put into the community, because it's there's not enough. There's never enough. But we certainly need to remove that stigma, and faith communities can be a place where students can talk about that.
Right. Talking about it helps. Funding issues are a longer-term problem. Dr. Williams, Duval County is one of the lowest funded areas in the nation, it's my understanding, when it comes to the treatment of mental health.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And we've worked a lot in this community to try and advocate at the state representative level, go up there and say, this is where we are as a community, this is where we would like to be as a community and a state, and to get them to put more funding in. And actually, they did released some funds last year for community mental health services. Mm-hmm. But that's just a drop in the bucket compared to what we need.
But you don't have to spend money to come to this event.
No, you don't.
That's right.
It's free, and it's coming up next Friday, November 4th, at 8:30 a.m. at the Schultz Center. Can you tell us a little bit more about the agenda and how people can be part of this?
Sure. It's a half day. It starts in the morning and goes till noon, so we break before lunch. You have two opportunities to break out into sessions, one which will be focusing on youth suicide, which again, as you said, is increasing at an alarming rate, and we need to have some awareness around that. And then the other breakout session is looking directly at the faith organization's role in addressing stigma for mental health. And then there's also a keynote speaker. Her name is Glenda Warren, and she's a doctor, an assistant professor of psychology and behavioral sciences for Morehouse School of Medicine in Atlanta. And she's going to also be talking about how faith leaders and mental health professionals can really work together and strengthen the community for those people.
And Kyle Reese, you host our popular quarterly radio program, Faith Matters, which is an interfaith discussion. Mm-hmm. So this conference, I'm assuming, will have a range of faiths represented too.
Very much so. And I've had the privilege the last couple of years of being a part and will be attending this year. It's a wonderful conversation of people who recognize the power of faith, but recognize that it is not disowning one's faith to get behavioral health help, and it's a wonderful collaboration.
Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, it's Baptist Health Third Annual Faith and Mental Health Conference, Friday, November 4th, at the Schultz Center in Jacksonville, and it's free and open to the public. Thanks so much, Reverend Kyle Reese, Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church, and Dr. Ellen Williams, who administers Baptist Behavioral Health. And we'll be right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, AT&T's bid to acquire Time Warner, what the proposed merger of the country's second-largest wireless carrier and a major content company could mean for consumers and the future of U.S. media and telecommunications. At 10 o'clock on 89.9 WJZT, your community, your world.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
Welcome back. Isn't that music great? It's indie favorites, the Squirrel Nut Zippers, and they are in town tonight at Jacksonville's Ritz Theater. The much-loved band is touring right now to celebrate the 20th anniversary reissue of their classic album, Hot. I spoke about the legacy of the Squirrel Nut Zippers with band leader Jimbo Mathis. Jimbo Mathis, welcome to the show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. How are you doing today?
We're doing great. We're excited to see you're coming to Jacksonville, marking the 20th anniversary of your album, Hot. I can't believe it's been 20 years since that album came out, but lots of excitement and lots of fans of your music. Tell us a little bit about the reunion tour and I think some bonus tracks that you've recorded, too.
The tour, it started out as going to be more of a reunion, but I'm turning it into a revival. So we're going to really kind of bring back to life and keep alive, you know, instead of just doing the one tour for the one event. I was able to assemble such a magnificent band that I thought it would be a real shame to just do, you know, one cycle of shows and then call it quits again. So we're really looking forward to new music and just, a big happy sunset, you know, right off like Hop Along Cassidy.
Very nice. Yeah. And some really talented people, part of your set from New Orleans.
Amazing players.
Yeah. And so I have so many questions. I never did figure out where you came up with the name for the band, Squirrel Nut Zippers. Where did that come
really?
From? Yeah.
Okay. Well, it's the name of a penny candy that I discovered up in North Carolina. It's like a 5-cent candy. And it's called Squirrel Nut Zippers, made up in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and starting in 1908. So you can still find them in like certain stores. And so it's just such a catchy name, and it's so quirky and odd like we were, that it seemed appropriate.
Yeah, it fits you guys. You guys are quirky and fun and a little different. And your music's kind of hard to categorize, but I think people like that about it.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a mixture of early American music, you know, mixed with vaudeville, hot jazz, calypso, cabaret, you know, and some like sort of dark humor and stuff in there. Always very theatrical as well, you know. And but really put it on sort of like a vaudeville show with different singers and different stage antics and whatnot. So very visual band. So it was just through a lot of research of early American music forms, you know.
Sure. And you'll be performing at the historic Ritz Theater. It's going to be exciting to see you live on a local stage.
Oh, my gosh. We love the old theaters, and it's just a perfect throwback when we can get up in a place like that. So it's always a magical time.
Well, thanks so much for giving us a few minutes. Have a great show. He's band leader Jimbo Mathis of the Squirrel Nut Zippers. Thanks a lot for being with us.
All right. Thank you, guys. I look forward to seeing you.
And the Squirrel Nut Zippers in town this week at the Ritz Theater. Go see them. We'll be right back.
Immigration right up at the top of the list issues-wise in this election, especially in industries that depend on it.
The American grower shouldn't be saddled with not being able to get enough people. And the thing is, these are jobs that nobody else wants to do.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Our series, How the Deck is Stacked, goes apple picking next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
The Westerlies are two trumpets and two trombones who defy musical typecasting. A little bit classical, a little bit jazz, a little bit folk music, and a lot of talent. I'm Valerie Kaler. The Westerlies are in the studio with me for Music and Conversation on the next performance today from APM.
Weeknights at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
Oh, my sweet Lucille, how did you ever manage it? You don't know what any of this means. It means cancel all your parties. Forget your big parade. It means the crowds will not be cheering. So despite what you've been hearing, you can lay down your spade. It means my mother can't stop crying. My rabbi's eulogy can wait.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour. Amid religious intolerance, political injustice, and racial tension, the stirring Tony Award-winning musical Parade explores the endurance of love and hope against all the odds, and it's coming to Jacksonville. Now, Parade tells the true story of Leo Frank, a Brooklyn-raised Jewish man living in Atlanta a century ago who was wrongfully convicted of the murder of his employee. This momentous case from the early 1900s drew national attention, and it was actually pivotal to the founding of the Anti-Defamation League. Parade will be performed next week at the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts. We're pleased to welcome David Loudermilk, director and musical theater department chair at DA. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Also in studio, the cast, Liam Morsansky, Tess Therrien, and Blake McClure, all students at Douglas Anderson. Hi, guys.
Hi. How are you?
Thanks for being with us. And we'll hear from the cast in a moment. But David, let's begin with you. Tell us the story of Leo Frank. How did this migrate from a true story to a Broadway musical?
It's gone through many formations. There was a great story of it on a original movie that was made about his life, The People versus Leo Frank, and then it opened on Broadway. And I think it's a very important story, especially now. It's interesting that it's 100 years old, but some of these things that are still following us, you know.
Sure, there's relevance in some of the themes. Leo was a victim of the anti-Semitism of his era. That's really the most important thing to draw from Parade, isn't it?
Yes, and we had a wonderful woman by the name of Rebecca Bennett come in from the Anti-Defamation League and spoke with the cast, and she had a great conversation with them as well. So we're trying to tackle both sides of the educational component for the students and the performance side.
Okay, so let's talk to Liam. You play Leo in the show, is that right? Tell us about your part.
Well, it's very interesting to be able to play Leo Frank as a Jewish person, because it's really given me a connection to my religion and to the cast at being that part. And I feel a deep connection with it that I really haven't been able to feel with my religion before that. And being able to tackle this issue of discrimination is something that's very important to me.
In real life, in Atlanta, in the early 1900s, people were quick to believe Leo was guilty of murder, even though he was innocent, right?
Yes.
Because he was Jewish.
Yes.
Yeah. So as a young man who's you've been brought up in the Jewish faith, when you learned his story, how did that affect you when you got the part?
Well, it was shocking to me that this happened earlier, and I had never even heard of this story until this year when I found out that we were doing musical Parade, and I did the research, and it was kind of shocking to me how something this big, I didn't even know about it, and most people don't know about it, but it was such a huge event in Georgia that was momentous in the creation of the ADL, and a majority of the population of Jews left Georgia after this actually happened. So it's just a big event.
And how did Leo's case spark the formation of the Anti-Defamation League? Can we share that history really quickly?
I'm not an expert on that, but I think it was just it went all the way up to, you know, Supreme Court conversations of things. And I think that there was just an understanding of the injustice and something needed to be done. So this group of people got together to start it.
And as Liam mentioned, this is a musical. Okay, so Tess and Blake, tell us about your parts in the show, because there's some song and dance involved, as well as telling a very serious story. Who do you play, Tess?
I play Mary Fagan, which is the 13-year-old girl who, she's poor and Christian, and she's the one who gets murdered in the basement of the factory and who Leo Frank is accused of murdering.
Okay, so she becomes the rallying cry for those that want to convict Leo.
Yes.
Yeah. And Blake, how about you? Who do you portray?
Yes, I play the role of Frankie Epps. He's sort of like Mary's love interest, I guess, at 13 years old. Him and Mary are very close friends. They were hanging out on the day that Mary later gets killed. After that happens, he becomes one of the forces of, hate against Leo Frank. He's angry and he's bothered and he just wants someone to...
He wants someone to pay.
Yes.
Sure. And we have Andrea in Jacksonville on the line. She has a comment about Parade. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air. Andrea, are you still with us? Hi, Andrea. Are you still there? Okay. I think she's your aunt. or she has a niece in the show, is what I was told, but we lost the call. But you know what? Let me ask you, David Loudermilk. This is a Broadway show. It's a technically complex, musically complex. It just shows you the talent at Douglas Anderson that you can mount a production like this?
Yeah, this is actually my first year at Douglas Anderson. So I'm very excited to come in and work with such talented kids in a talented department. Everything is done by the students, student orchestra. The students help build the set and the costumes.
Very exciting. And this is happening next week, November 3rd through 6th, at the Douglas Anderson School of the Arts in their Dubow Theater. It's the Tony Award-winning musical Parade. Get your tickets now and see these talented kids. A very relevant production. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
David Loudermilk, director of Parade, and he heads up musical theater at Douglas Anderson. And cast members Liam Worsansky, Tess Therrien, and Blake McClure. Again, Parade at Douglas Anderson next week. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Merschart. Michelle Corum runs the board, and the show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a show. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and the WJCT app. And next on Diane Rehm, AT&T's bid to acquire Time Warner. That conversation's coming up. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day and enjoy the music.
In my sweat, it means I've got the greatest partner any man can get. It means I'll never, ever, ever underestimate that woman, 'cause this is not over yet. Tell my uncle not to worry, tell the reaper not to hurry, make the hangman stop his drumming, 'cause I'm coming into town to win the day. Somehow I haven't with my scheming, screwed things up beyond redeeming, and we're finally on our way. And no, this isn't over, hell, it's just begun. Hail the resurrection of the South's least favorite son. It means I took a vow for better, and two is better than one. It means the journey ahead might get shorter, I might reach the end of my rope. But suddenly, loud as a mortar, there is hope.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.